Good afternoon. It's Tuesday, the 17th of January, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. Of course, with me in the studio, Mike Robinson. And, well, where do we begin today? We're just going to have a little recap of the fact that we've got the Daily Mail, amongst other papers, saying that Parliament is to be closed. And I've said, as that top headline, as David Noakes predicted, in 2006. Now, I think that's about the right year, but we're talking just about 10 years ago. Maybe it's slightly over. David Noakes, who was working with the UK column at that time, said very quietly one afternoon, do you know, I think what they're going to do is come up with a scam that Parliament needs massive amounts of money spent on it, and they will move the MPs out. And what is the scam? Well, we've got vast amounts of money apparently needing to be spent on Parliament. A minimum, it would now appear, of 3.5 billion. And I'm going to say that having spent a little bit of time working in the building industry, including dilapidations on big office buildings, including some of the EU buildings, I have to admit, that these are just phenomenal sums of money. And I would like the public to be able to see the evidence, the factual dilapidation sheets, listing out the defects and listing the cost of remedial work to correct that, so that we can see exactly what the truth is. I'm also, Mike, I've got to say, slightly suspicious that it takes Chris Bryant to go down into the bowels of Westminster to point at wiring. I'm not sure whether he's qualified to look at wiring and plumbing conduits like this with any form of real knowledge. But I suppose we should be grateful at least he's wearing more than his underpants.
But £3.5 billion.
It's an astonishing amount of money.
But it's a very easy problem to solve. Just close the BBC for a year and there's the money.
Well, this is true. We'll come on to the BBC a bit later in the news. But of course, that still leaves our MPs either being moved where? To Manchester, of course, was always put forward as a possibility. Apparently, a committee is advising the MPs that they should move out now. So just at the instance that Britain's in a very turbulent phase with the coming out of the EU or not, we're also now saying, well, we've got to move our parliament out of Westminster. Nowhere for them to go. But I suspect they'll sort of drift around the bars and cafes and nightclubs of Soho while they do their business. This is planned, Mike. There's no question of it.
Absolutely. Quite a lot of news today planned for all kinds of stuff. Because, of course, the main news agenda is Brexit and Theresa May's Brexit speech, which apparently he's going to define exactly how we are, has defined exactly how we're going to get out of the EU. This is what she had to say a little over 6 months ago. The British people voted for change. They voted to shape a brighter future for our country. They voted to leave the European Union and embrace the world. Did you vote to embrace the world?
I braced to support I wanted to support and embrace my country first. Actually, right. I think charity begins at home. We should be looking at this country first. This government or the previous government couldn't run Britain. How can they possibly embrace the world? This is dangerous bunker mentality.
Well, actually, embracing the world in this sense, I think, is the Black Widow spider, which is quite appropriate, bearing in mind what Theresa May is. But we move on. She said it means taking the opportunity at this great moment of national change to step back and ask ourselves what kind of country we want to be. Well, again, this was absolutely clear before the vote what kind of country we wanted to be. There was nobody suggesting that we should take this opportunity for change and drive the change forward using Brexit as the excuse. But that seems to be what's going on. she said, my answer is clear. I want this United Kingdom to emerge from this period of change stronger, fairer, more united, more outward looking than ever before. So she said she wants it to be fairer. Keep that in mind. This will be a thread all the way through this. I want us to be a secure, prosperous, tolerant country, a magnet for international talent, and a home to the pioneers and innovators who will shape the world ahead. I want us to be a truly global Britain, the best friend and neighbour to our European partners, but a country which reaches beyond the borders of Europe to a country that gets out into the world to rape and pillage, sorry, to build relationships with old friends and new allies alike. I want Britain to be what we have the potential and ambition to be, a great global trading nation that is respected around the world and strong, confident and united at home. So that's fantastic. Let's see what else she said. Our vote to leave the European Union was no rejection of the values we share. So apparently we share values with the European Union. I thought the whole point was we didn't share values with the European Union, and therefore that's why we needed to be out of it. But anyway, she says we share the values with the EU. The decision to leave the EU represents no desire to become more distant to you, our friends and neighbours in the EU. So we're going to leave, but we're not going
to
leave.
Well, people wanted to get away. They wanted to put some distance between themselves and the political regime that is the European Union. So they wanted distance. We don't want it.
Right.
That's not the same as saying you don't want to go to France for your holidays.
Yes. So we will become more global and internationalist than ever before. So we're becoming internationalist. We've always been internationalist, but we're becoming more internationalist. But, you know, this is flies in the face of this whole populism thing that she's complaining about constantly, which she says is a rejection of internationalism and globalism. But she says Britain's going to become more internationalist. So it's the same agenda. Let's move it forward. We will become a stronger, fairer and more global Britain too, as I've said, so fairer. And the same rules and laws will apply the day after Brexit as the day before. Because, of course, the Great Repeal Bill, as we've mentioned many times in this programme, the Great Repeal Bill winds in all the European laws that have been created and turns them into domestic law.
So we leave the EU, but essentially everything that the EU has implemented in this country is then locked into concrete.
Correct. And if as I listened on through the speech, what became clear is that she intends that with the trade deals and other EU military integration and others, although she didn't mention that specifically, but it was clear that what she meant was that we start off with this at this point of Brexit. We start off with parity between the laws of UK and Europe, and that will continue as we go into the future.
Yeah.
Right. Let's see what else. A bold and ambitious free trade agreement with the European Union. So TTIP failed, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership failed. But what we're going to do is we're going to drive forward these free trade agreements in the style of TTIP, and we're going to create one with the European Union. We're going to create one with the United States. And so will that not just be TTIP if we've got the US, Britain and the EU all in free trade agreements?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so agenda stays the same. Let's move on. It's not membership of the single market, honest gov. Now, those aren't her exact words, but that's basically what she said. She said, we're not going to be paying into the single market anymore because we're not going to be part of the single market. But there may be some European projects that we want to be involved in. EU military, Europol, maybe some other things, which maybe we do want to pay into. So we'll continue paying in, but we won't pay in.
Yeah. So good. We're coming out, but we're not coming out.
I hope this all makes perfect sense to everybody.
Well, I think it does, unfortunately. But yes. We'll talk about that a bit more.
And the other thing that she absolutely said was that that Britain represents the most effective hard and soft power. So we are most effective with our hard and soft power. So that was her speech today, and in a nutshell. But I want to move on, because following on from this, I want to move on to something else. Now, just have a quick reminder of what Theresa May said late last year at the Mansion House speech, because she was, as I say, talking about globalization and people being left behind. And if you remember, she said, and I think if we take a step back and look at the world around us, one of the most important drivers, she was talking about the drivers for Brexit and also the election of Trump and this other so-called populism that she worries about so much. And she said, if we look at the most important drivers, that these become clear, the forces of liberalism and globalization have left too many people behind, right? Too many people left behind. And in her speech today, she was talking about fairness and more fairness. Fairness was a word that was used over and over again during the speech today. So I wanted to highlight this report from the Joseph Rowntree Foundation. And this is a report to the RSA, the Royal Society of Arts Inclusive Growth Commission.
Can I just interject there? I always find it fascinating that the Royal Society of the Arts, which most people think is about art, seems to be about something completely different.
Absolutely, absolutely, because this is all about fairness and inclusivity, because no one is to be left behind, no one. So, as I say, this is a submission from the Joseph Rowntree Foundation and the Inclusive Growth Analysis Unit at the University of Manchester to the RSA Inclusive Growth Commission. They say this submission draws on the learning and evidence base developed through the Joseph Rowntree Foundation's Cities Growth and Poverty Programme, including the work of the Inclusive Growth Analysis Unit at the University of Manchester. It also draws on wider evidence from Joseph Rowntree Foundation. It shows how cities can get on and do more to deliver inclusive growth now, and includes a series of recommendations for citizens, local government and central government. So what is inclusive growth? Well, inclusive growth is a concept, and it's defined as a concept that advances equitable opportunities for economic participants during economic growth and benefits incurred by every section of society. So in other words, inclusion is one of the most important words spoken with regard to diversity, but the most frequent spoken words among them could be inclusive growth, which means making sure everyone is included in growth regardless of their economic class, gender, sex, disability and religion. So hopefully that's clear. Who's driving it? The United Nations, the OECD, that's the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. So what is Joseph Rowntree saying? Well, they're saying that devolution is not a panacea for inclusive growth, but they say that the Brexit vote has highlighted the level of disconnection and dissatisfaction felt by many people in many places across the UK. The rise of populism on both sides of the Atlantic is a stark reminder of the potential social and political consequences of growth, which is not inclusive. It is worth noting one of the key finders from the Joseph Rowntree Foundation's report, Brexit Vote Explained, which was that poverty, low skills and lack of opportunity that people from all levels of qualification we're more likely to vote to leave the EU in low-skilled areas compared to high-skilled areas. So again, we're talking this, that it's only the thickies that vote for Brexit.
And Theresa May was stressing, of course, how we need more skilled, intelligent people to come into the country.
Absolutely. They complain in this report about the dominance of London in the South East, so that's the northern powerhouse. They say that inclusive growth is an agenda, not a political and not a policy initiative. So it's an agenda like Agenda 21 or Agenda 2030. And in fact, it's heavily related to those. We believe it should become an organising principle for cities. Taking this step does not require new powers or responsibilities or permission from central government. Cities can take the lead now. City leaders, perhaps in particular forthcoming metro mayors, have the opportunity to be champions of inclusive growth, raising ambition, shaping strategy, inspiring action. It all is very positive language, but of course what we're talking about here is a new form of governance. And economy is being used as a driver for that. And they say we should encourage the Commission to be bold, not just pragmatic. Yes, it should exploit the opportunities for immediate change, but it should also set a longer-term vision for achieving more inclusive growth and the relationship between central and local government and between cities and their citizens. So we're talking about the relationship here between individuals, government, at whatever level. We're actually talking about the big society. So who is this that's running this? As we said, it's the Royal Society of Arts. And they previously ran this, the City Growth Commission, which considered what is needed to enable our cities to thrive, driving economic growth, creating jobs and enabling cities to become fiscally more sustainable. It examined what political powers and governance arrangements are needed to deliver this, as well as how integrated public service reform can improve outcomes for local people and the economy. So this is big society, the shared society, as Theresa May is calling it now. And this is part of the agenda which sits in parallel with Brexit. You've got to see all these things as being interlinked, because what we're talking about is a complete redefining of governance and how we are governed. And it's not something that we would necessarily, it's not something that we would want in any way, shape or form if we actually understand what it is. So this is the latest initiative, the Inclusive Growth Commission, launched in April last year. It's, they say, an independent, impactful inquiry designed to understand and identify practical ways to make local economies across the UK more economically inclusive and prosperous. No one gets left behind. In other words, it's all fairness, fairness, fairness. It's chaired by Stephanie Flanders, who's a former BBC economics editor, and also by JP Morgan, chief market strategist. That's what she's doing at the moment. So she's doing this in her spare time. And it's building on the success of the previous City Growth Commission. So devolution, governance, city state, city regions, because as was said on the BBC Today programme a day or two ago, Brian, Britain is no longer a nation state. It's no longer a country. It is a nation of countries and regions.
Yeah, so it's broken down into those EU regions. And of course, London was always designated under the EU agenda as being a city region, city state, a country in its own right, of course. And that is one of the key reasons why, of course, Parliament's got to be closed. We've got to get rid of British Parliament from out of London. London then becomes a key European city-state.
Yes. So if you want to get a bit of background on this, please have a look at this article just recently published on the UK Column website, In Pursuit of Fairness. This is part one of a series of articles by Martin Edwards. You want to understand why fairness is suddenly right at the heart of policy. You need to read this. And I would also just remind people to once again have a look at the Global Parliament of Mayors and the Abolition of the Electorate, another article on the UK Column website. It'll give a bit of background to this. Now, related to this is a bit of an ad for an event this evening. Starts this evening, live at 5 o'clock. If you go to the Global Daily website, you'll find this. This is Strategic Development Goals, Sustainable Development Goals Live, SDG Live. And that starts tonight. This is from Davos, because the World Economic Forum annual meeting at Davos is happening at the moment. And they say that, of course, as one of the foremost gatherings to bring together leaders from across sectors to share ideas, discuss industry, regional and global agendas. And so they want to discuss the Sustainable Development Goals tonight. If you're interested in that, do watch. I think probably find some interesting stuff going on there.
Yeah.
Okay, change of subject. Rolls-Royce. This is fascinating because Rolls-Royce has agreed to pay penalties of £670 million plus interest and costs to avoid prosecution. So here we have a deferred prosecution agreement. This is pretty much a deferred prosecution agreement. It basically means as long as you pay us a load of money to the Serious Fraud Office, then they will not pursue charges. So yeah. Nobody actually gets prosecuted for corruption.
This is okay for big commercial interests to do, like Rolls-Royce. But of course, if the Serious Fraud Office was coming after an individual, this wouldn't be going on.
Well, I mean, it is a step forward, Brian, because although nobody's going to get prosecuted, of course, nobody got prosecuted for the Al Yamama arms deal with Saudi Arabia either. And of course, the Serious Fraud Office lost the files for that, if you remember. So what this means is that if they pursue these deferred prosecution agreements, is the Serious Fraud Office can continue to lose files and not have to worry about it because it never goes to court. So it's a good deal. It's a good deal. So in total, £497 million to the Serious Fraud Office, $169 million goes to the US Department of Justice, and $25 million goes to the Brazilian government.
Yeah,
because of fraud and corruption.
And a little bit goes in brown envelopes to other people that we probably won't be aware of.
Quite possibly, yes.
Yeah. Well, if we're talking Rolls-Royce, that leads us nicely into defence. And, the Telegraph wins the prize here for spin and half-truths. Navy facing heaviest Russian activity since Cold War, says the First Sea Lord. I've got to say, I started to read this article and I began laughing because it is so utterly childish that the whole thing is ridiculous. We're going to have David Ellis from Strategic Defence Initiatives on tomorrow, and we're going to look at this in greater detail, but let's have a little look today. Apparently, the Royal Navy is facing the greatest challenge from Russian submarines and warships for more than 25 years. Well, I have to say that I was in this game 25 years ago. I was a specialist in this field of finding submarines. And apparently, we simply thought the Russians had gone away. So we're surprised to find out what's happening. So the First Sea Lord comments, follow a warning last year by the commander of the US Navy's European fleet, that NATO was on the verge of a new battle of the Atlantic with increasingly sophisticated Russian submarines. So even the Americans totally surprised that Russians have suddenly, well, they've still got submarines, and actually they're very good ones, Mike, and they work. But the Americans are surprised, the British are surprised.
Shocker.
I don't know what's been happening over the last 25 years, but apparently people are now surprised that the Russians are operating submarines. And then he says here, or the Telegraph says, the decision to scrap the troubled Nimrod maritime surveillance aircraft in 2010 has left the country vulnerable to the sort of activity that Russian submarines conduct. Now, I'm reading, this is out of the Paddington Manual of Naval Warfare. This is unbelievable because, of course, the activities of Russian submarines or British submarines or American submarines or Chinese submarines has never changed over the last 25 years. They are still doing exactly the same job. But the disingenuous part of this, of course, is that the Nimrod maritime patrol aircraft were a key part of defending our strategic nuclear deterrent. And when they were scrapped, our nuclear deterrent was left vulnerable. Nobody wanted to talk about it. And then we've got the power plants of the Type 45 destroyers, which are to have engine refits after a string of power failures, have turned out to be less reliable than originally envisaged. We were a little bit surprised that these engines were not quite as reliable as originally envisaged.
Are the engines in the F-35 going to be as reliable as originally envisaged?
When they're not bursting into flames, Mike, when they're not bursting into flames and when the airframe is not dissolving with corrosion problems, the F-35. But I just have in front of me again the letter which my local Conservative MP, Gary Streeter, said to me. He said, as expected, your fears about HMS Duncan, the Type 45 destroyer that was towed into Plymouth, were not well-founded. And I'm sure that you'll be reassured to read the contents of the enclosed letter. And that letter was a letter from Harriet Baldwin, MP, Parliamentary Undersecretary for Procurement. She said there's no concerns, no worries, nothing going wrong with the Type 45 frigates. But apparently there is, because the First Sea Lord has said so. So let's bring on the First Sea Lord. Here he is. I'm sure he's a very nice chap. Philip Jones. I've probably met him a few times, but that would have been many years ago. But here's his startling revelation. In Northern Europe and the Baltic, we are responding to the highest level of Russian naval activity since the end of the Cold War. He's surprised, Mike. Mm. I don't know why he should be surprised, but all of a sudden, where have those Russians come from? It's remarkable, isn't it? So we carry on through, and this is where it gets really interesting. So we use Russia basically as a scapegoat. Russian analysts fear the jump in submarine activity to levels not seen since the 1980s is accompanied by increased efforts to spy on Britain's nuclear deterrent. Well, this is complete nonsense, because that is what the Russians always attempted to do. It's what our submarines attempt to do off the Russian Northern Fleet bases, and it's what the American submarines do. So this is regurgitated falsehood. This is fake news.
Yes.
This is fake news. I don't think it's the increase in absolute number of missions that the increase in concern. It's the information that these Russian submarines are trying to collect. Well, the Russian submarines are not interested in the size of Theresa May's leather trousers. They are there to get information on what British warships and our nuclear submarines are doing. But apparently we're surprised. And then Russia's been ramping up its presence in the North Sea at the same time that other countries have been winding theirs down. Well, what they're talking about is Britain, because Britain has been cutting its armed forces. Now, all of a sudden, we're saying how outrageous those nasty Russians have actually been building up their armed forces. We didn't know, but now we know we're a little bit short of ships. So I'm going to push this point. Here's the First Sea Lord's smokescreen of excuses. He's bleating that the Royal Navy has insufficient ships and aircraft for the job. But Royal Navy senior officers did nothing and said nothing as the government scrapped aircraft carriers the Harriers, frigates, destroyers, submarines, and of course the Nimrod aircraft. Those same senior officers allowed David Cameron to betray them and the nation with a cheap 50-year defence pact with the French, of course, who couldn't operate in the same professional capacity as the British military anyway. And then defence and strategy and procurement has been prostituted out to private think tanks, NGOs and low-level government officials producing shoddy, unfit equipment, including ships that don't work. And then we've got gutless senior officers who've sold out the services to the politically correct government agenda. So it is outrageous that this man should try and hide behind the Russians while the fault of the state of the Royal Navy today is totally in the lap of his senior officers who simply did not have the guts to stand up to the government. And I better just bring this in with a smile on my face, because if you go to the Honourable First Sea Lord's Twitter page, he's busy boasting about cyber warfare. And this, of course, is because we're to get excited about cyber ships because we haven't got the real thing, Mike.
Right.
And just a little advert that come and join the column tomorrow. As I say, we'll be with David Ellis and we're going to have a look at what this is really about so that people can understand just how the country's been betrayed, not only by the Labour government, but of course by the Lib Dems hand in glove with the Conservatives.
Okay, let's move on to Yemen, because the United Nations has decided that the estimated death toll in the Yemeni war has passed 10,000. They gave a press conference yesterday. It was this gentleman, Jimmy McGoldrick, who's the United Nations Yemen Humanitarian Coordinator. He said, "I don't know the figures, but the estimates are that over 10,000 people have been killed in this conflict and almost 40,000 people injured." But the fact is that he said that in August last year. So I'm assuming that there's more people now because Saudi hasn't stopped bombing. So he doesn't actually have a clue what's going on. I'll just highlight the quote that was on RT from Kim Sharif. Now, we had her on UK Column News about a year ago or so. She is a human rights lawyer in specialising in Yemeni issues. And she told RT that these people are committing, this is the Saudis, committing war crimes routinely, systematically against the people of Yemen. So there's no question that it's more than 10,000 at this point. Now, what Jamie McGoldrick said yesterday, he went on to say that there are about 11 million people in Yemen who need some sort of protection in terms of human rights. He said, well, I'm not quite sure what some sort of protection might entail. Of course, perhaps stopping the Saudis bombing, weddings, funerals, whatever it is they feel like, that might be a good place to start with offering humanitarian protection to people.
It might be. I think they're unlikely to get it. So let's bring in the European Union, because thanks to an eagle-eyed viewer, we were given some really outstanding information very early this morning. So let's have a look. This is the document, and it's media neighbourhood, it's journalism training, and it's a handbook for journalists. And why are we interested in it? Well, this is all about the EU's neighbourhood project in reality, but this is about training journalists so that they can use European Union sources of information to promote the European Union.
The word media there, Brian, it looks like the same kind of typeface and colour as BBC Media Action uses.
Well, Mike, this is pretty impressive that you should say so, because who actually produced this document of how to recruit, train, and use journalists for the best possible outcome of the EU is the Media Action.
Right.
They were given the contract, and here they are at the bottom. Of course, the EU says it was also involved. Of course, they were paying for it. But the EU then says, well, but we're not responsible for anything in this booklet.
Oh.
So they commission it, they pay for it, they use BBC Media Action to produce it, but then they say we're not responsible. This is because they're trying to distance themselves and make it look as though they're independent. But actually, this is the EU training in-country journalists to promote the European Union. And it's very clear if you read the document. Now, interesting that the BBC should actually be promoting this. I can't show you too much on screen because the typeface on this is very small, but I can read you a bit. It says the European Union has 28 member states with more than 500 million citizens. Spend some time familiarising yourself with the structure of the European Union by browsing the websites in the adjacent European Union section of journalism resources. So what this document does is takes people through all the resources where they can go to read the EU propaganda about itself in order to feed this out to other people.
Undoubtedly, this is completely balanced, and they've got some anti-EU links in there as well.
No, it's not balanced at all, Mike. This is utter EU propaganda, and what they are doing is recruiting and training young people to become their journalists in their country of origin. So EU embedded journalists in their country of origin. And who has put this document together? The BBC. Well, let's go on because we got a bit more here about the European neighbourhood policy background. Developed in 2004 to avoid the emergence of new dividing lines between the enlarged European Union and its neighbours. It's going to strengthen prosperity. Greece is doing well on that, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
Strengthen prosperity, stability and security. And this leads us in nicely to problems that Yemenis have, because let's look at where the European Union is going. Bilateral policy between the European Union and 16 of its closest neighbours, Algeria, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Belarus, Egypt, Georgia, Israel, Jordan, Lebanon, Libya, Moldova, Morocco, Palestine, Syria, Tunisia and Ukraine. So as we'll see in a minute, what this is about is a European empire, which is truly just spreading. We can only just describe it as that. And what is the EU doing? Well, as we're going to see, it's going to be pumping in money. How much money? Well, a lot of money. 15 billion euros, to be precise. So 15 billion euros, of which they're putting up 2 billion, it would appear, towards this propaganda and media campaign in order to get into these border countries and to spread European values.
Good.
Okay, so let's remind ourselves about the BBC's supposed charity. It says we use the power of media and communication to reduce poverty and support people in understanding their rights. These people are too stupid, Mike, to understand their own rights. They need the BBC to come in and help. So legally, financially, operationally, Media Action is apparently independent of the BBC, apart from the fact it shares offices, it uses the public BBC pension pot, and quite clearly it's on board with their operational directives. They're a charity, but they assist the EU political agenda.
Because the EU is a charity case.
Well, you're not supposed to be a charity and be political. This is a bit common purpose-like. But here is the BBC absolutely pushing EU political policy. We sit in the BBC's World Service Group. That's World Service, World News, BBC Monitoring. But Media Action is independent. I wouldn't like anybody to get confused because they're independent. And they're independent, but they're also heavily funded by the EU, US and UK governments. So that's all pretty good, too. And they provide mentoring and training for EU journalists. So let's have a look at it. Here's the pie chart. And if you have a look at the big 33% of funding, that's straight out of the British government for the Department of International Development. But we've also got the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. We've got the European Union, United Nations, the US and the Norwegian government, etc. So this is not a charity. This is a government-sponsored political organisation. And we found more, which we're going to do more work on. Here's another journalist handbook covering relations between the EU and its neighbourhood partners. This is part of the inside. And we picked up on this bit because now we can see what the EU is really pushing. EU human rights and justice, EU economic and rural development, EU civil society, EU education, EU energy, on it goes. So this is EU political policy being pushed by the BBC via a, well, I'm going to use the word, a false proxy charity.
Yeah, because this is really important, because this brings us right back to the start, because EU civil society, EU shared society, Theresa May's shared society, rather yeah. big society, it's the same thing. It's the same policy agenda operating in both places. And nothing has changed as a result of a speech that was made today, or, you know, nothing has changed.
Nothing has changed. And you were spot on, Mike, when we came out with the Brexit was simply a psyop. There is no Brexit. What you're just seeing is a drift across to a parallel path. But let's look at the monster the BBC is helping to create. So this is another part of the document. Now, this is talking about the funding side, the European Neighbourhood Instrument. There's the mere 15.4 billion euros. And then we get this map, which I find fascinating. So don't forget the money. This is not a few million euros. This is big funding for big political project. And here's the map. This is like the expansion of the Roman Empire, Mike, because we've got the EU in dark blue there. And then we can see all the countries of interest. So the EU's eyeing up all those borderline states with Russia. No wonder the Russians are getting very uneasy. And then we're moving right around the Mediterranean rim, just as parts of the bigger empires were. And, of course, we've got the Middle East there, all in light green. So these are of interest to the European Union. Hence, we can see what the problem is with Syria, that the EU was not able to get in and take control of Syria.
So it does look very much like the Roman Empire, doesn't it?
It's uncanny, Mike, uncanny. And we just put a little more emphasis on what the priorities are. Now, these are not our priorities. These are the European economic and political priorities, economic rural development along the lines of the EU, human rights, etc. And we've got BBC Media Action driving this. So the BBC, I think we've nearly got the lid off. The BBC is not just fake news. We're looking at one of the most unbelievably dangerous propaganda machines I think the world has ever seen, hiding behind this charity, which is itself embedded in the EU political model.
Yes. Okay, well, Theresa May's speech may have grabbed most of the mainstream political headlines, but we should mention this, and this is actually an extremely important case, because the Supreme Court in the UK today ruled on government's responsibility for alleged, well, they say that they're responsible for extraordinary rendition. So this was the case of Abdul Hakim Balaj, and he is now clear to sue Jack Straw, amongst others. Because the Supreme Court agreed that this was a complete breach of his rights. Now, why is this so important? Because actually, the Supreme Court didn't... He was taking this to the Supreme Court on the basis of European human rights law. And actually, the Supreme Court ignored that and quoted Magna Carta at length. So they quoted that no free man shall be taken or imprisoned or dispossessed of his liberties or be outlawed or exiled, or in any way destroyed except by a legal judgment of his peers or by the laws of the land. And so Magna Carta, again, Magna Carta has never failed in a British court so far, because we haven't got this European style law fully embedded in our system yet. Once again, it's been used by the Supreme Court, and we've got to applaud them for that. So he is now free, if he wishes, to sue Jack Straw. Also, Sir Mark Allen, who's MI6's former head of counterterrorism. He can sue MI6, MI5, the Foreign Commonwealth Office, the Home Office. Of course, they all denied any wrongdoing. In fact, he was simply looking for nominal damages of £1 and an apology from the British government. Well, I don't think he's going to get it. But nonetheless, this is an important case because of the way that the Supreme Court has ruled. Making use of Magna Carta.
Yeah. Well, we often get asked, can't we put in some more good news into our news? And we thought today we should mention alongside this that there's clearly unrest amongst Britain's judges. And we've heard from a number of sources murmurings over quite some time, but it does now appear to be the case that judges, or some of them at least, are getting very uneasy at how we're seeing freedoms and rights stripped away in this country. And as Mike has said, the reliance back on Magna Carta is an extremely important step because it has implications in so many other areas. So we would say to our audience, as with the police or even people working for the BBC, please don't brand everybody with the same brush, because clearly inside big organisations there are people who are concerned at what's going on. We need to encourage them to speak out. Now, how can we give you an example? There are other things afoot. Well, thank you very much to the lady who said, are you aware of this? A court case where essentially 210 judges have challenged the government over changes to pension legislation. Now, on one hand, you could say, well, it's all right for the judges. They've bandied together to take on the government over their pensions. But actually, it does show something that these people are not fully in bed with the government, because the changes in these pension arrangements would have actually hurt these particular judges. So the case is taken. This is part of the document. You can now find it online. And the judgment has come out that basically, and you picked this up, I think, from the Telegraph, was it, Michael, the final result, that the government's ending up with a huge liability.
Yeah, so Liz Truss was criticised for being unfair to the junior judges because she had changed their pension terms without any real legal basis. And so the government now liable for £100 million costs to make the pension scheme the same for all. Judges. So,
and of course, a precedence case for other people who might take on the government due to pension changes. And we can expect pension changes because, of course, the great lie is there is no money to pay the pension pot.
Well, because we're getting so old so quickly that there isn't enough money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're going to end there today. Thank you very much for joining us. As we need to say to you, if you like what we do, you want to support us, please take out a subscription and or make a donation, because we can only run UK Column News with your financial support, your donations. So if you like the product, help us by taking on that subscription or making a donation. And what we would like to do in 2017 is expand the range of information that we're able to get across. We think today we've highlighted some extremely important material, the great conservative lie of Brexit. We're also seeing the immense danger as Britain's armed forces are simply dismantled. And then in the background, we've got this massive EU super state, which is not declining. It's using effectively soft power to embed itself in nation states in order to collapse their own government and install the European Union. This is pretty dark stuff, but when people can see what's really happening, we can do something about it. That's it. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back same time tomorrow. Bye-bye. Bye.